Hey everybody, how are you guys doing? I'm Colleen Fabry and this is Venture Europe. Venture Europe is a series of conversations with successful entrepreneurs, investors and ecosystem contributors where we discuss about the strategies, tactics, frameworks and failings that they have used and experienced during their journey. It is my personal vendetta to contribute in making Europe one of the most attractive entrepreneurial ecosystems in the world. Big words, hard work, so let's get started. This episode is brought to you by Vauban, the easiest way to launch and run your venture investing. An all-in-one integrated solution to form syndicates, VC funds, and co-investment SPV programs that are built for the next generation of global venturers. From fundraising to exits, Vauban provides an automated back office that handles the legals, banking, investor onboarding, and administration, which allows their clients to focus on what matters: finding the next unicorn and building investor relationships. Vauban has facilitated over $1 billion of capital invested in companies such as Revolut, Bolt, and Airbnb, among others. Find out why funds like Antimus, Octopus Ventures, and BackVC, just to name a few, are using Vauban by heading to vauban.io. And now, back to our guest. My guest today is Tony Jamus, founder and CEO of Oyster, a distributed HR platform that empowers companies to hire, pay, and care for talented teammates regardless of location. Tony founded Oyster in January 2020, and since then they have raised around $220 million, grew the team to approximately 600 FTE, and have reached unicorn status. Prior to Oyster, Tony founded Nexmo, a pioneer in the communications platform as a service category. The company went public via a merger with Vonage in 2016. After a successful Nexmo exit, Tony took some time off to consider what to do next. He began to invest in platform models that can change the world. Tony's investment include Hopin, Hyperloop, GraphCore, and Dialpad. During this episode, we discuss about the challenges and learnings of starting, scaling, and exiting Nexmo, why removing the barriers of global recruiting is important and the mission of Oyster, and how he hired the executive team at Oyster to increase the chances of success. Without further ado, please enjoy this excellent conversation with Tony Jamus, founder and CEO of Oyster. So, Tony, welcome to the pod. Let's start with the story of your first business. So just to set the stage a bit, you work in sales for a couple of years and then you decide to found Nexmo. I was wondering, what was the catalyst for you to take that risk to move from a comfy job and build a business? And maybe you can tell us a little bit about what Nexmo does.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me here on the show, Colleen. So I always wanted to be an entrepreneur. And that's why when I left my work, I went to do business school in Switzerland, which I've learned a lot there, but I realized actually it wasn't really fit for an entrepreneurial career. It was MBA schools are fit for landing you a job in a big corporation. But when I was there, I stumbled upon a book called The Monk and the Riddle. It is a book that talks about the deferred life plan and why you should not defer your life plan and you should go after what you need and what you want right away. And that have convinced me that I should consider starting my business right after business school. And before going to the business school, in my sales job, I was working for one of the leaders of mobile technology platforms back then, mobile messaging platforms. And they assigned me a project about the APIs. APIs were something new. There was really no APIs in the world at that time. So I worked on this project and customer loved it. But the company decided to shut down this project for a number of reasons. And when I went to my business school, I was obsessed with that opportunity. And I took that opportunity of adding API platform on top of a globally fragmented messaging network, SMS. You have, you know, hundreds of carriers around the world, 180 countries. And I look at that opportunity through the lens of marketing, strategy, finance, innovation. You know, I used every piece of my MBA program to build my business plan. And when I graduated, I was ready. I was ready to start the business. But when you graduate from a business school, the biggest thing you have is liability, because essentially you want to pay back your loan. You spend so much money to this expensive education. So I needed an investor. I needed a job before I get an investor. So I started interviewing, and parallel, I was looking for investors. And I had a an ex-customer of mine in Morocco, who's an entrepreneur, a tech entrepreneur in Morocco. He never invested in his life. And he told me, Tony, whatever you do, I'm going to invest in your business. So I called Aziz and I told him, look, actually, when I landed my job, I was offered a job of an assistant to CEO of a large multinational telecommunication company. And I went and I spent a week with the CEO. And before I signed my contract, I called Aziz in Morocco and said, Aziz, look, I'm about to sign this employment contract. Would you like to invest or no? And he said, yes. So I went back to the CEO. I told him, sorry, I'm starting my business. And then this is how Nexmos started in early 2010.
And what was the debate in your head if you should take the risk or not? And what was the conversation with the CEO?
Yeah, the debate was, if I can secure funding, I should absolutely do it because I would have solved my financial issues to pay my MBA school. I already paid it, but I was broke, didn't have anything left. So that was the only thing was, can I have a safety net? If I have a safety net through a form of investment and the opportunity to fall back and find another corporate job if I need to, then it's a no-brainer decision. And the reaction of the CEO, he knew. He told me, like, I knew you're going to go start your own company. He understood that. And we stayed in contact and we became friends after that. But I did not join him.
And what are some of the learnings and challenges from starting, scaling, and also exiting Nexmo? I just read in the press that you kind of exited for about $230 million.
Yeah. So Nexmo grew rapidly to $100 million of revenue in the first 5 years of operation. And in mid-2016, we merged it with a public company called Vonage on the NASDAQ to accelerate our entry into the public market. And I stayed there for a couple of years, tripled the market cap of the company in the result. And more recently, last year, it was acquired by Ericsson for $6.5 billion. The company was last year already nearly $1 billion of top line revenue. So the challenges we faced there to scale were numerous. The biggest one is, how can you build a company that operates in 40 plus countries and make it scalable? Because of the nature of our business, we had to employ people in all these countries to build relationships with carriers and to develop the local markets. So that actually, I could solve the cultural issues. We could build a unified culture. I could solve the collaboration and communication issues. There's lots of tools and methods to do that. But one thing I could not solve was, how can I create a great, consistent employee experience no matter where people are? And I couldn't understand why it should have taken me 6 months to hire Muhammad in Morocco. I found Muhammad is amazing talent. I need to go find a lawyer, hire an accountant, a payroll provider, a benefit provider. I have no clue what great employment look like in Morocco. And despite the fact that we spend millions of dollars building our internal employment infrastructure, we failed to deliver scale for our team. We were bloated in terms of legal and HR and finance to be able to manage that. But also we failed to deliver a great experience for Mohammed in Morocco and everybody else in these 40 countries. And that led me to think about Oyster. This is how Oyster idea came to life, is that there must be a better way to do this.
Yeah, tell me more about Oyster. So you have this problem yourself, then you're thinking it just must be like a better way to do it. You exit Nexmo and then you are with the company a little bit longer. And then you're like, okay, I want to start a company that solves this problem. Because if I have this problem, probably multiple businesses have this problem. What are the next steps that you're taking? How do you build a team?
Yeah. So at Oyster, the learning I took from Nexmo was, the best team wins. And I look at the data back then in late 2019, when I was gearing to start Oyster, I found that unicorn companies, companies that reach over $1 billion valuation in less than 5 years, have over-invested in their executive team earlier than other companies. And I partner with a guy called Andrew, who was the general manager of True Search in Europe. True Search is like a large executive search firm. He left his company and he partnered with me to design what is the best fit for purpose and mission aligned executive team look like before even getting funding for the company. And we went on for the last 2.5 years. Actually, we started the business in January 2020. He hired pretty much everybody on my executive team with a stringent process of interview a high number of talented people for the role. We do a case study with a short list of candidates. And we ensure that we optimize for fit for purpose. So essentially, they have seen this before. They have experience in this. So they already have a relevant experience. Example, Emily, our SVP product, she was at Carta, replacing lawyers with software. We have Miranda, our general counsel. She was at TriNet taking employment compliance and implementing into software. We have Kevin, SVP marketing. He took Buffer, which is a social media platform, and turned it into a remote work iconic company. So we really kind of optimize. I can continue. Every one of my team is here for a reason. And they're all mission aligned. They are here to make a difference. They don't need a job. They can find any job they want. But they are here because they want to make a difference. And that change in how we recruit, fit for purpose and mission aligned, makes a huge difference in terms of alignment of the team, in terms of speed of making decisions, in terms of trust within the team that is absolutely needed if you're running a distributed company. Like we do, we are in 70 countries. We're 60% women in terms of diversity, including on the executive and leadership team. Very proud of this craft of the organization that you were able to deliver in the last 2.5 years.
That's amazing that actually you were so thoughtful of getting Andrew on board and have the fit for purpose and then mission align. They have done that before, so they can also do it. And how do you scale that up? How do you look at it now? You're a team of almost like 600 FTEs. So just like 2 years ago, you were only 20. So I would assume that you were just very thoughtful in the beginning, you know, with the executive team. How do you scale that quickly? So what are the things that a company has to have in place to go through this hyper growth period?
Yeah. So number one is have a scalable team yourself, right? So I've built scalable companies in the past, but I need everyone on my team have experienced hyper growth in their career. They know what they're getting into. They can anticipate challenges. I think that's number one. Number two is you need to have a strong culture. A strong culture, you know, I'm not talking necessarily about the values. The values are definitely really important. I can tell you more about that, but it's also the culture is how you work together. You want to be very prescriptive of how do you get stuff done. How do you build trust in the team? And you need to model the way, you as a leader of the organization and that team. And in our case, as a distributed company, we have created a model that is called Follow the Sun. This is our own way of working across time zones, and that gives people flexibility and freedom, but yet deliver high level of engagement and high level of productivity. Our engagement levels are top 2% of all VC-backed companies.
What does that mean? So engagement level, top 2%.
Yeah, so we use a tool called Culture Amp that other VC-backed companies use, and they survey their team on a regular basis. They take a pulse of the organization on various dimensions, and then they rank essentially your results versus the market.
Got it. And also, I remember seeing like a post on LinkedIn that you have made that you work on specific hours where you feel the most productive. And also, you just mentioned now the Follow the Sun model. Do you want to tell me a little bit more about how do you see productivity and how do you actually make sure that your team is highly efficient and competitive and they're working hard, but at the same time, they have like their own maybe time zones and maybe families? How do you see that?
Yes. So it starts with creating a culture that measures outcomes versus inputs. And why this is important? It's important as a distributed company because you're not anymore asking people to come work in the office and you're not correlating the presence of the person in the office with results. So you have to change the chip as a leader and as a manager and trust that people are doing their job based on what you expect from them. And to do so, you need to have the infrastructure to be able to set expectations clearly and measure them on the individual level, on the team level, and on the company level. We use at Oyster, we use a methodology called Objective Key Result, OKR for its acronym. And we have the maturity of a company that is 3 times of our size when it comes to setting the right goals and measuring them on individual, team, and company level. So you owe it to your team to create an environment that can make them successful no matter what they are. Secondly, you need to adopt your own version of asynchronous work. So you need to find the right balance between synchronous and asynchronous. So in our case, most of our work is asynchronous in the company, less as you go up in the hierarchy, because as you go up in the hierarchy, the tasks become more ambiguous. So you need more sync time than when the task is much more defined. But we thrive to be increasingly asynchronous. So today, for instance, on Tuesday morning, I have all the videos, all the Loom videos of my team, my direct reports about what happened in the last week and where they need help. in Tuesday evening, I have my call, my executive team call, where everybody have already consumed in advance the agenda. They came prepared. So the conversation become much more effective and efficient. Like every meeting I do that qualify need to have an asynchronous component where you send me something in advance, I consume it, it's blocked in my calendar, the time for me to consume it. So I'm not under pressure to find time to consume it. So, and we also have Focus Friday. Focus Friday is a day on Friday where we don't have any internal meetings. It's 100% async day. And that enables me to go through everything I need to go through at the end of the week, clean up my inbox, clean up my Slack channel, and be ready to go in the weekend and completely disconnect. We also don't expect people to respond immediately on Slack. So if you ping me on Slack, it could take 2 weeks to come back to you. I might assess the urgency, maybe on PTO. If it's urgent, you can text me or call me. Rarely happens. But essentially, you want to protect the privacy of people, protect their own way of working, and make sure to create an ecosystem for them where they can be successful no matter where they are.
Interesting. And I think this is key for a future where people are working all over the globe. They need to feel comfortable that they can do their work with a combination of deep focus, synchronous communication, but as well, asynchronous communication. So you are operating in the future of work trend or industry now. What does the future of work look like from your perspective? And why is removing the barriers to global recruitment so important?
The future of work that I like to see is work that is more equal in terms of access to opportunity. And the barriers of that is the ability to employ people in other countries easily and fairly. And I've spent a lot of time before starting Oyster looking at this question, both macroeconomically and also from an impact standpoint. Just to give you some data point, Brian Kaplan, who is the economist of George Mason University, in his book Open Borders, he argues that if you remove the concept of borders from talent mobility, you can triple the world GDP. At the same time, you have 90 million jobs going unfulfilled in the West, mostly knowledge work. And according to BCG, that's $8.5 trillion economical loss. While at the same time, you have 1.5 billion knowledge workers coming into the workforce in the next 10 years. So I don't see a way other than cross-border employment to be able to capture that lost economical value. And by doing so, you elevate talent from emerging markets. When you think about it, if you are an amazing student in the top university in Cabo Verde, which is one of the smallest African countries, and you graduate, the best job you can get there is to work for the local bank. Just wait 5 years, human capital potential will plateau. But if the same talent get access to some of these 90 million jobs opportunities in the West, that think differently about enabling human capital, then that person can grow with the opportunity while staying back home. They don't have to brain drain. Today, the biggest problem in this in the world creating inequality, one of the biggest problems is brain drain. The best brains of these emerging economies have left. They are leaving in masses to go work for corporation in the West and leading their communities. Now they send back home 5% of their income on average. That's remittance. It is the biggest foreign direct investment, FDI, from north to south is remittance, but it's only 5% what they earn. If they stay home, they can bring back 100% what they earn, and they can stay in their communities and access the world as they oyster when they're looking for a job. It has to happen, and it needs a platform that makes global employment as easy as local employment. Today was our platform. Companies can, with a few clicks, hire Mary in Athens, Mohammed in Morocco, or Diego in Argentina, and give them a fair and a safe employment experience.
I love the vision. Love to see that you are working on it. And tell me, like, where in the journey are you with Oyster and what is next?
Yeah, so Oyster started in January 2020. The first year was really building the infrastructure, getting the first customers, building the software, building the team. And it was a very unique year. As you know, we had the lockdown, the first lockdown, and realized that we had to go really fast. So we built an employment infrastructure in 180 countries, employment platform that makes global hiring as easy as local hiring, and built this massively diverse team distributed in 70 countries. And last year, we started growing like crazy. We've grown 20x last year. We've reached double-digit ARR in terms of our top line, and we raised in total over $220 million funding. We reached a unicorn status end of Q1.
Congrats.
Thank you. And by the way, we're very fortunate to raise our Series C end of Q1, early Q2. That was the timing was perfect. So we got fortunate twice at Oyster, starting the company in January 2020 and raising our Series C $150 million a few months ago. So now the journey is really about how do we exit Oyster from this phase as a more resilient and a stronger player in the category. We've created this category with other players in the market. We call it Global Employment Platform category. We've created an iconic future of work brand that is leading the way in terms of change that's happening in the future of work. And we've delivered social impact. We've produced our impact reports on our website where we measure our impact on businesses, people, communities. And we want to be a major foreign direct investment vehicle, shifting capital from north to south in 10 years. We want to be sending billions of dollars to emerging economies. And we want millions of people to elevate millions of people from these people that want to have the opportunity. They are ready. They are well-educated. They have good infrastructure to work from home. We want them to participate in the global technology job market and beyond.
Amazing. I mean, I'm from Romania and I left just to get a better job, right? And I see now, like, in a way, you're privileged when you can stay next to the family or next to a community where you kind of grew up and so on and so forth. So it's a lot of talent that are moving from their home market to the West because of better jobs. But actually, if you can open the opportunity to work from next to your family and to work for a global company, I think it's just amazing. And I just wanted to congratulate you for all the achievements that you have made so far. I think you're also lucky, but also probably you are prepared to take advantage, you know, of these opportunities. So let's change gears a little bit. Let's get personal. You were the first 10 years of your life surrounded by civil war in Lebanon. How did that affect you and how did that influence the man you are today?
Yeah, I was born in 1980 in Beirut. This was in the middle of the civil war. It ended in 89 and 90. It was one of the most confusing and brutal and cruel war in history. And I was living 2 miles from the demarcation line between Beirut East and Beirut West, where most of the shelling happened. And for the first few years, I was okay because essentially you are in that environment. You don't know your child. You're growing up. You don't know what's happening. So essentially, I was fortunate to be very close to my grandfather. He gave me safety and warmth that children need in such an environment. Unfortunately, he passed away when I was 7. And since then, I felt a continuous sense of lack of safety in the world. And that has shaped the person who I became, not only from a business success standpoint, because you know, when you feel lack of safety, you want to go and start. You want to become successful to protect yourself, right? In this world that tells you, you know, monetary success is the way you protect yourself. So I was very driven. It really created that drive for me to be successful because I was lacking personal safety. And it's also on the downside of that, living in constant fear, dying or anything else, create post-traumatic stress disorder. So I've been suffering for post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, for all of my life. You know, more recently, in the last 10 years, I was becoming more aware of it, and I've taken concrete actions to alleviate this mental health condition. And how it drives me today is like, think about safety. I'm committed to create the safest work environment for my people in the company. Work is not safe. Work is a place where we go to work and our fear and anxiety are amplified. We are afraid of being wrong, we are afraid of saying something stupid, we are afraid of being judged, and so on and so forth. We're afraid of losing our jobs. And so my goal is to create the safest environment for work in the world. And why I do that, because if I create safety for others, I can give safety for myself. It gives me internal peace. And that's the journey.
Wonderful. Very mature of you, you know, of the awareness of looking back and see how that shaped you and actually how you can change the current present for the people that you are working with. What was the most challenging period in your career and how did you overcome it?
Compared to my ability to handle challenges, because that ability improves over time, you know, I think the challenges I have now are bigger than the challenges I've had next month in my previous company, but I'm more equipped now. Back then, the biggest challenge I faced was the phase where we had to merge the company with a public company. Why it was challenging? Because first, mergers, you know, there's always high risk of failure. 80% of M&A fails. Secondly, it was a public company. So you could not talk about it internally. You had to keep a very small team of people knowing about it. It would have been announced at the same time as the earning call to the whole company. And so you had to plan behind the scenes integration with a bigger company that is public. So I was lucky to be surrounded by people who knew what they're doing. I was lucky I had my general manager, Lewis, who really came and filled the gap in terms of my operational abilities to merge two relatively big companies together. And also, I had to do a lot of internal selling at the new company to make sure that my company had been perceived, rightly so, as the star of the future, because my company was doubling every year in terms of growth, already at a big, we were $100 million, we were getting acquired, and we were doubling every year, while the other businesses were merely growing, some of them are declining. So I had to kind of go in and shift the capital allocation to the high growth, higher potential segment of the business. And that worked well. The company invested in it. It has grown rapidly. After I left, it went from $1 million to nearly $1 billion in a few years of top line. And really, it was the reason why the company got acquired by Ericsson for $6.5 billion last year. So yeah, that was a challenging period of my life to be able to do that operation and still deliver a very successful outcome for the company, despite the fact that 80% of M&A fails miserably.
Thank you very much for sharing. Also, I know that you have to jump in another meeting. So let's end up with the last question. So if Tony from now would meet Tony from 10 years ago, what would you tell him?
Stop fighting. Everything is going to be fine. And why? Because we get caught into these thoughts. You have to do something to fix something. Yeah, you have to be reactive to all these events that happen to you in life. And my message to Tony 10 years from now is to increase your level of acceptance of what's happening to you. And because you cannot change them, all you can change is your reaction to them. And that reaction creates unnecessary pain and suffering that you can remove and also reduce your negative impact on others as you do so as a founder and a CEO.
Increase the level of acceptance. Love that. Tony, thank you very much for taking the time. This was a pleasure.
Thank you for having me.